When it comes to capturing the human experience, nothing does the trick quite as well as a documentary film, unless, of course, it's a riveting study in fiction. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101, and on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss a pair of documentaries, Amazing Grace and Ask Dr. Ruth, each a study of a well-known American celebrity that explores each particular individual's specific talent. We'll also take a look at the intriguing Korean film Burning. So don't touch that dial, because Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
When you hear us say, listener-supported public radio, what are we really saying? Public radio is shorthand for thought-provoking, well-crafted, stimulating programs. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs. And not only the programs, but the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you those programs. So here's a very large thank you to you, the listener, in listener-supported public radio.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that is enjoying the fact that spring finally has arrived here in the Inland Northwest. That hasn't stopped us, however, from heading indoors to seek out the best in contemporary cinema. Our quest this past week took us to Spokane's film treasure, the Magic Lantern Theater, where we saw two documentaries, Aretha Franklin's film 1972 concert titled Amazing Grace, and the profile of America's most unique sex therapist titled Ask Dr. Ruth. We also checked out the video on demand offering from Korea titled Burning. Let's begin, in fact, with an Asian film that simply doesn't fit easily into any single category. Take a base of François Truffaut, blend in a healthy dose of Patricia Highsmith, and season with a bit of Michelangelo Antonioni, and you have Burning, a film by Korean writer-director Lee Chang-dong. Basically a three-person set piece, Burning is a study of mood and place set in and around Korea's capital city of Seoul. Jong-soo is a young college graduate and would-be writer who falls for the pretty high Mae, a young woman who knew him when they were children in the rural city of Paju. When Jaime asks Jong-soo to take care of her cat while she heads off to Africa, he agrees, only to be surprised and disappointed when she returns in the company of Ben, a handsome, obviously rich, and mysterious guy who says that to him, work and play are the same thing. Director Lee, whose previous film Poetry tells a moody story about, of all things, crime, dementia, and poetry, likes long, involved scenes and a narrative that keeps the audience off balance through his film's ending, and maybe even beyond. But he makes affecting cinema, one replete with stunning visuals and characters whose emotions are as raw as they are liable to explode, ultimately, with repressed desire.
You mentioned Lee Chang-dong as the director of Burning, and he is, you know, an important figure when we're talking about this. And I think he's one of the great filmmakers to come out of Korea, even though he's not very prolific. He's only made a few movies, and this is his first film since 2012, 2013. But another name that I think we should bring up is Haruki Murakami, the Japanese writer who wrote a short story that this film was based on. And I've read several of Murakami's novels, and a lot of his pet themes are in this film. You've got a strange cat. He loves using cats as plot devices or as symbols. You've got a missing woman. You've got an empty well. You have unexpected violence. All of those things pop up throughout Murakami's bibliography. And so it was kind of interesting to see all of those things come up in Burning, but in a totally different country.
That's and right. Applied to Korea, which is a completely different.
It is. And another film that Lee made that I think people should check out, the one he made before Poetry, is called Secret Sunshine, which is about a woman that moves back to her husband's hometown after he has committed suicide. And it's about her trying to basically acclimate to this strange town that looks at her as an outsider. And this movie has a lot of similarities to that one. And it's such a fascinating film, isn't it? I mean, watching this movie unfold over the 2.5 hours that it does, and it does so quite patiently, and we're never really sure where it's leading us. And that is both exhilarating and kind of terrifying at the same time, because we just know that something bad is going on.
And the
on
one
here.
Thing that Mary Pat said to me while we were watching it, saying, I wish we were watching this on the big screen.
I know.
We were watching it on our television set, and I wish we were at the Cinerama in Seattle.
It's a beautiful film, and of the many great scenes in Burning, I think my favorite and the most beautiful is this scene that's set at sunset, as a song is playing, and our three protagonists that have formed this weird love triangle,
pathological unity of sorts,
they're stoned and they're watching the sunset, and these colors are flashing through the sky, and the woman takes off her shirt and starts dancing. And just the way that he uses color and movement and sound in that particular moment. And it's something that a lot of filmmakers wouldn't have included. They would have said, this doesn't forward the plot in any way.
Absolutely.
And yet, I think it's the key to unlocking this movie, because you really just kind of have to let it work on you.
Right, because it doesn't enhance the plot or move the plot forward, but yet it tells everything right in that particular moment.
And the dynamics between the three of them.
Yes, because we're watching them watching her. So we wonder throughout this entire performance, because she's alluded to dancing previously throughout the movie, and she does it unprompted and encouraged at different points. But is she dancing for an audience? Is she dancing because of this greater thing that she's trying to, the great hunger that she talks
about?
And it
sets up a scene that happens about an hour later in the film. It previews that very scene that is a major plot device that at this point we're starting to go, oh, I see what's going on here.
And we're starting to wonder how conscious she is of the fact that these two men are ostensibly fighting over her. Steven Yeun, by the way, is probably the most well-known actor in this film, and he does an amazing job. He this chilling portrayal of this guy who, I don't want to give away too much, but clearly has something nefarious going on in his life. There are all these weird clues, basically, that
and
he's
leaving
behind.
And he drives a Porsche with no obvious means of support.
And we wonder how aware he is that this other guy, who's basically
Gangnam Style,
who's basically the nice guy in this relationship, how aware he is that he's competing with him. The power dynamics there are really fascinating,
and so,
but it's only one element of this
movie. Well, because this is really all about relationships. It is about politics. It is about masculinity. It is about rage. And
class.
It is about,
you were pointing out it was about class.
It's really about class. And we see that writ large in one scene where Jaime is out with Ben and his friends. And we can never really tell, are they aligned with her in some way, but it appears as though they're amused by her, as though she's a little plaything.
Right, and the camera keeps cutting to Jong-Soo, who's observing everything.
And he seems to know what's going on.
Slowly.
He's like
an outside observer. Yes.
Right. I saw Burning as an organism that keeps evolving. It's a very unusual film in that it doesn't follow a standard three-act structure or a standard plot arc. It starts off as what we assume is going to be some kind of romance, character study, as these two people reconnect.
Jules and Jim, that's what it seems like.
And start to know each other. And then this mysterious figure, this Ripley figure, if you will, you alluded to Patricia Highsmith earlier, comes in. And so it becomes almost this bitter social commentary.
But then it becomes Antonioni,
and it becomes something of a mystery. And then in its final moments, almost like a slow motion horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's constantly finding new ways to surprise you. And yet every new twist of this story feels organic. It feels like that's what's supposed to happen. That's where we were going this entire time. And yet it doesn't appear that there's a through line from the outset.
I just had a couple of observations. One, you mentioned in passing that part of the action takes place on a farm up near the North Korean border. And it's so interesting because we hear the propaganda on the loudspeakers from across the border. And so that's something that, you know, I've never really seen or even thought about in that
context. Sometimes while Miles Davis is playing on the guy's record player or
and I think the other thing that's intriguing to me is Ian Yu, who's the major protagonist, I mean, he's a big star in Korea. And, you know, I'm always wondering about the sort of cultural transfer among these movies and so forth, because we do have these things going on, these gender tensions, these class tensions. And I wonder if here's this big star, this TV star that's been in like this mini series. He's done these historical dramas. He's done all this stuff. I wonder how that plays out, because they have the ultimate fan culture in Korea. Mm. They follow all of their every moves and so forth and so on. So
even that is included in this film. I mean, that's how he meets Jaime at the very beginning. I mean, she's standing on the street and with this little sexy outfit, you know, it's a come on. It's all.
I really liked, and you had mentioned this, Dan, when we were talking about it. There are several scenes in this movie where Jung-soo, you can't figure out really how old he is. I mean, we know he's graduated from college, but sometimes he seems to be a boy or an adolescent, and other times he seems to be trying to adopt this more machismo persona and so forth.
As far as I'm concerned, Manola Dargis hit it right spot on when she said he's an adolescent who hasn't quite adjusted to his adult body, because he's walking around slouching and everything. I also have to admit that when the credits came up and it felt totally natural, at the same time it was like, really? But then it's like, I have got to think about this. There were times in this, I kept telling to Mary Pat, of course, we talk in our house while the movies are going, I was going.
Not at the theater, though.
No, not at the theater.
No.
But I said, this is so symbolic of some of the great film masters of all time. It's, I see the French Wave. I see some great European film here, you know. And yet, at the end of that movie, I was dumbfounded. In a good way, though. It is going to take your average filmmaker a second to adjust to what they've just seen.
It's a mystery that doesn't unlock itself at the end.
Absolutely.
Like a lot of mysteries do. And even though you're right, I think that there are a lot of allusions to 1960s European films, which were also proud to be obtuse a lot of the time. But it's still very much a Korean film, and we're getting some great work out of Korea right now. There's lots of stuff that we don't get at all that I'm sure is also
I can really imagine.
Good.
The other thing that the two writers, haven't really talked about, there is this writing theme throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept waiting to see, is this real? Is this a story or whatever? But it's constantly referred to by various characters at different points. So I think that's an overarching theme as well.
Totally.
That's right. And that was Burning. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the documentaries Amazing Grace and Ask Dr. Ruth. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Korean film Burning. Let's now move to a couple of documentaries, Amazing Grace, the long-awaited film version of Aretha Franklin's 1972 gospel concert, and Ask Dr. Ruth, a profile of the celebrity sex therapist Dr. Ruth Westheimer. Let's begin with some music. Perhaps the most amazing thing about Amazing Grace is the very fact that the film ended up getting finished, much less released. Filmed over the course of two nights at a Los Angeles church that looks more like a former movie theater than a place of Baptist worship, the documentary was problematic from the beginning. Intended as an accompaniment to the gospel LP that Franklin was recording, an LP that would go on to become the best-selling gospel recording ever, the film suffered from its director's inexperience at shooting musical performances. That director, the otherwise esteemed Sidney Pollack, forgot the most basic of filmmaking tools— clappers that would allow editors to synchronize the filmed images with the sound. And so the film sat until music producer Alan Elliott took over following Pollock's 2008 death. And even though Elliot, with the help of a team of computer experts, managed to cobble together a print, Franklin, for her own reasons, wouldn't authorize a release. So it was only after she died in August of last year that Elliot was able to reach an agreement with Franklin's estate, a deal that now allows us to see the images that go along with one of the most distinctive vocal talents of all time.
Absolutely. I think it's difficult to separate out this documentary from Aretha Franklin herself. And it also gets complicated because on the one hand, we're trying to figure out to what genre does this film actually belong. So is it a concert film? Not really. Is it an extended music video? Sort of. Is it memoir? And I think the answer to the last should be yes, except Aretha Franklin herself pushed back so hard against the screening of this film when it made the festival circuit in 2015. And I haven't really fully understood or appreciated that aspect of it. Like, did she not want this film to be released for personal reasons? Did she not agree with the quality of it?
Did she think she wasn't getting paid enough?
Right. I don't know.
Complicated question.
It's a glimpse into the life of this amazing, amazing star. And we do see her relationship with other people, most notably her father. And I think that that was sort of an intriguing portrait. So as little as we see everything at the same time.
Yeah, I think what Amazing Grace is, especially now that Aretha Franklin has died, it's almost a monument to her.
Right. And I said memoir, but you're right.
Yeah.
Monument
yeah.
would
and
be
I
more
found,
accurate.
I found this, it's obviously a great performance. I think Aretha Franklin is the greatest vocalist of all time, just opinion time here. But I think that this film is such a fascinating object because it's kind of like what we talked about when we discussed The Other Side of the Wind, the long-delayed Orson Welles film is, well, how do we talk about this? Because the people that originally made this thing aren't around to see the finished product. So what do you call it? And I think that because it's basically raw footage. There are shots in this film that are out of focus. There are shots where
out of sync, actually.
Right. I mean, and there are times when they're not editing around the other cameramen. So we see other cameramen in the shot. We see Pollock himself directing the cameramen and they don't cut it out. So it's basically an approach that's born out of convenience because what else are you going to do with all of these different reels and shots? But oddly enough, I think that again, it's not a stylistic choice to make this movie this way. I kind of think it's the ideal way to see this performance because it has this immediacy to it and this electricity to it where we feel like we're really in the room with not only the musicians themselves, but with the people that were making this movie and documenting the performance. And so all of the electricity of Aretha Franklin's performance doesn't feel forced. It's right there. This movie is, I think, one of the great concert films, but it's the polar opposite of something like The Last Waltz or Stop Making Sense, where every shot was storyboarded. This is a movie, it feels like it was made on the fly.
Very 1970s.
Absolutely. And because of that, I think even though Pollock came out of live TV, and I guess if you look at something like They Shoot Horses, Don't They, it has a lot of handheld, jittery camera work, and maybe that's why they thought he would be a good fit for this project. But I think that he accidentally made this great film out of the fact that he didn't know what he was doing. I don't know how to verbalize this, but
if he overlooked some basic technique, and I still don't realize, maybe we'll have to ask our son-in-law who does a lot of post-production work, how you do manage to sync this up after the fact. But Warner Brothers hired him to do this, and that's a good question, why? To showcase the album.
He was hot at the moment.
Okay.
But how does he make that rookie mistake of not bringing the clappers?
I know.
Seriously.
Well, it's such a strange thing. And so what Elliot and his team of editors
that's the other thing I was going to point out, Pollock is really not credited. It's Elliot
realized,
a film realized by Alan Elliot.
But what Elliot has cobbled together with this raw footage is something truly extraordinary, I think. And I have no idea what Pollock's finished version would have been. I don't think it would have been anything like this. I think it would have been much more polished and put together and
he might have thrown in some talking head
something like
also,
that. Yeah,
which Elliot insisted on not doing.
He would have maybe given us some more context, historical context, musical context, all of that stuff. But the fact that this is just Aretha Franklin on a stage and we're just watching people watch her.
Including Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and just watching like the choir behind her, having the visual, the visual accompaniment of this great album is something really special. I'm going back to see this a second time. I think it's really great.
And that was Amazing Grace. Let's close with Ask Dr. Ruth. There's always been something incongruous about Ruth Westheimer, all 4'7" of her, speaking so frankly about sex in her almost comically heavy accent. But that was part of her charm, that and her willingness to talk openly about issues that, when she first drew public attention in the early 1980s, very few celebrities were addressing. Issues such as the female orgasm, as homosexuality, as AIDS, and so many other things that surprised so few of us in 2019. In his profile of her, Ask Dr. Ruth, documentary filmmaker Ryan White captures not only Westheimer's charm, but also shows how this German-born daughter of Orthodox Jews, both of whom became victims of the Holocaust, is active to the point of obsession. And she has remained so even into her 90s, suggesting that her intent is both a sense of obligation to educate the masses, as well as a means of avoiding memories that almost anyone would find too difficult to confront.
I didn't really know what to think about or to expect about this film. And in the opening sequence, I was like, I don't know about this. But it won me over completely, especially the animated sequences that are interspersed throughout. And she really is a fascinating, delightful human who had these specific credentials. And it was one radio producer who saw the potential for her really adding something to our human experience by talking frankly about sex. We spend a lot of time with her, and she's a dynamo at age 90. And we do get a good sense of things that shaped her, but she is very closed off. As much as she's willing to talk about these subjects frankly, she's not willing to talk about other things at all.
Right. That's the great irony of it, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that this film, Ask Dr. Ruth, falls into the same camp as some recent documentary smash hits like RBG. And Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers documentary, in the sense that it's basically an infomercial for the charm and influence of its subject to a degree that I almost find a little boring, because it goes into some incendiary stuff, because they talk about the fact that she won't discuss politics, even though it's pretty clear what
she's
her politics are.
She's reluctant to identify as a feminist, and when her granddaughter pushes her.
There are critics who have said that her advice is too sensationalistic, or that she's reckless. There's a guy that comes on and says she's reckless. But the movie doesn't go anywhere near that, really. It kind of brings it up and then skirts away. Ruth Westheimer is at the center of this film, and she's unbelievably charming. I mean, you can't not be won over by her.
And her backstory about the kinder transport is amazing.
In Switzerland, it's living there from age 10 to 17, and then going and becoming a sniper in Israel in 1947.
And then almost losing her legs in a bombing.
Dumping two husbands because, hey, you know.
Yeah. One wasn't smart enough.
Right. I mean, I think all of that is good. You know, these documentaries, they're nice profiles, I guess. I just wish there was a little more there, but she's a fantastic subject. Don't get me wrong. So I was also won over by this movie, despite my objections, just because she's so great.
Yeah, I agree with Mary
Pat.
It was the first 10 minutes I was thinking, oh my God, do I have to sit through another one of these? But then slowly, as her story became clear and as she became the center point of what Ryan White was doing, I ended up liking the movie and all that, even though I agree with every single qualm that you have about it, Nathan.
It's fluffy, but I mean, some of it isn't. Some of it is very heavy, but as a personal profile, it's
solid. And I think
that
those of us who lived through that time period recognize that she really did have a huge impact
absolutely.
On the national dialogue.
That's right. And that was Ask Dr. Ruth. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed the Korean film Burning and the documentary Amazing Grace. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you, too, our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember these words from the late, great writer William Faulkner. The only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.